Start of interview with V.L. Wirasinghe, 26th of September, 1967.
As I said, I couldn't ask you about the land development ordinance last time. I was wondering in what area you applied it and roughly what...
Where I worked?
Yes, what period?
It is now, 1938 40, I was in Hambantota district. Did a little bit of it there, but not really very much. Later, in the Batticolo district, I had 45 minutes left to do.
Oh, I see.
When I was in the Hambantota district, I spent a lot of time on the merely on the issue of the new permits to replace the old the present proprietor permits.
That's on Crown land?
Crown land.
Oh, yes.
Well, yeah, before the Land Development Ordinance came into force, there was a scheme called the Peasant Proprietor Scheme.
That was
a large number of permits had been issued under that old.
Oh, a large number?
Oh, yes, very large number. And they were most of them were converted to Land Development Ordinance permits.
Under this Peasant Proprietor Scheme, what exactly happened? What was the difference?
Well, the present proprietor scheme was much the same as the land development ordinance scheme, only it had no legal backing. It was merely under the administrative instructions issued.
Mm-hmm. I think it must have been administered for about a decade before the LDO came, or was it even more than that?
At least a decade, I should think, but I couldn't be certain of that.
No,
at least a decade, I should think, because I remember my father used to speak of it when I was still at school.
I have some familiarity with the main provisions of the LDO, but I was wondering how you would describe its main aims as you saw it in the field.
Yes. Well, if you went about it systematically, you would first have the mapping out. So you went out, an appropriate officer went out and mapped out the crown land available in a village or a group of villages for the various purposes for which crown land might be mapped out. And there, of course, you heard representations from various people and did it as democratically as possible. And then, of course, you would know what land had been mapped out for the various purposes, some of which, of course, would be mapped out for peasant allotments, for middle-class allotments, capital development by capitalists, and so on. Of course, the main emphasis was on land to peasants under these LDO permits. And in mapping out, that kind of prime requirement was kept in view by the mapping out officers. I myself did an enormous amount of mapping out in the Batticolo district. But there we had the difficulty that much of the land was had not been settled by the land settlement officer. So much of it was very tentative.
So really, what was necessary first was land settlement work?
That would be the best thing, of course. This is kind of optimal.
Mm.
But since land settlement work was so tardy, we couldn't afford to wait until the land settlement was done. So we took a risk and assumed. Sometimes, of course, the assumptions were fairly safe to make that this was coming then. And you generally knew from the headman whether there might be claims to such and such land. So if there were going to be large claims, then your whole mapping out might go awry. it might very well be that land you had intended for peasant allotments, for example, might be claimed successfully by private parties as the own.
Yes, but since the headman had given you some inkling, I presume you tended to leave out those where...
Yes, those which for which the claims were likely to be made, we would just leave alone, unmapped out for the moment.
And with regard to the LDO itself and its aims, what would you say they were?
Well, earlier, much of the alienation of Crown land had been haphazard, and particularly in the infantry, much of the land had been given out for estates and for other purposes to the prejudice of the local people. So with this mapping out, particularly, you sought to kind of remedy that kind of situation and to obviate it wherever possible. And thereafter, of course, the intention was that there should be kind of well thought out planned development of the villages. And in planning that development, subject of course to overriding national considerations, the interests of the people of the area were to be met.
Well, as for this form of tenure itself,
mm-hmm.
Would you say that one of its primary objectives was social, that is, the protection it gave to the recipient, the allottee?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering whether you consider it as having other objectives besides that.
How do you have in mind?
Now, for instance, I was wondering whether there was the major object of encouraging food production, by giving them a secure form of tenure,
mm-hmm.
and B, by virtue of this nominated heir,
mm-hmm.
One nominated heir,
mm-hmm.
having what they consider to be an economic unit.
Yes. Now, basically, of course, as the title of the ordinance itself suggests, land development is the purpose. And in developing the land, one wanted to see that the benefits accrued to the people of the area as far as possible. There might be, of course, overriding national interests. Yeah, you'd have to, perhaps now in colonization schemes, for example, you bring people from outside as well. Or it might be that you'd have to set apart land for forest reserves and so on, which would be of use to the whole country as for the country as a whole, not only for the people of the area. But once the land was given out to these peasants, it was intended that it should be developed by them. And lands were given out for various purposes, agricultural, residential, for animal husbandry, so forth. Mm. And of course, in planning this out, there'd be land allocated for lands set apart for schools, dispensaries, hospitals, and such like to community purposes. And so far as the nomination of an heir is concerned, as you said, the government was interested to see that there would not be breaking down into uneconomic units.
Mm. Have you any idea on what basis they drew up this unit of 5 acres of paddy land and 3 acres of highland for each family?
Well, it was not invariably five and two, was it?
Five and three.
There were variations from place to place according to availability of land and also the fertility of the land, the ability of the people of the area to cultivate land. Sometimes the peasants themselves would say, well, 5 acres is more than I can handle. I don't have the buffaloes, I don't have this and the other, so make it small. Because the government, we always stipulation that there must be development, otherwise the allotment will be taken away from them. So through fear of that, often they ask for smaller units. But the idea, of course, was that this was an assessment of what would be a viable viable unit, that the 5 acres would be necessary to keep family, to keep the family in a reasonable, reasonably good financial situation.
Mm-hmm. From experience, it would seem that where it was applied in the dry zone anyway, it was too big a unit in the, for the colonization schemes.
I think that is generally correct. Now, I was in Marthale, the city of Marthale, and there were these allotments given at Ellaharra. It did happen that when the 5 acres were given, there were certain allottees who just could not manage it, and they left a certain area uncultivated, and that was detrimental to the whole tract. Of course, in some families we found grown-up sons and others even their relatives who might come along and help them with the cultivation could manage the 5 acres, but it wasn't invariably so that they could manage it. Of course, in a place like Ellaharra, or in the dry zone generally, with mechanization, might have been possible to do it. Now it might be possible, although at that stage it might have been difficult.
That is a sort of cooperative types of mechanization.
Cooperative types of mechanized cultivation. Mm-hmm. In fact, we were trying to encourage that in Ellaharra even in the old days. And where the land is flat, or reasonably flat, you can do quite a lot of mechanization.
To what extent do you feel that this form of tenure gave them protection from Mudalalis, Chettiars and Moors, from losing the land?
Well, they just could not lose the land except through the government cancelling their permits. It did give them all that protection.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, for that same reason, I'm merely theorizing. I don't quite know in practice how it happened. For that very reason, they may have found it difficult to get loans from the Mudalalis. So you have to have a better centralized credit.
Did they have it at that time?
No, they didn't have it. Because subsequently these various cooperatives were organized.
Yes, in fact one of the criticisms has been expressed in this phrase, what is the use of giving them land without giving them some sort of capital and leeway?
Yeah.
But didn't you help them with houses and
we did?
Seed paddy?
Yes, we did help them with houses, with seed paddy and other planting material, with common wells where necessary, irrigation facilities were provided.
Any instruments?
Oh yes, mammoties and so forth were given, but I can't remember that we gave any ploughs and so forth. We certainly provided mammoties.
So in that case, have they any ground to complain about the capital?
Well, what happens is, of course, that although that is given, they no kind of subsistence allowance was available until the harvest came round. And until they've got the land prepared and so forth. So they needed something to carry on with. That was, I think, the main trouble. And most of these chaps, what they did was, of course, they mortgaged the harvest. And in doing so, they got very poor terms. Mudalali exploited the situation. And eventually they sold the harvest pretty cheap.
You noticed that happening in your time?
Oh, yes, exactly.
I will take the reference to this, to the extent of support given.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering whether it was because authorities of the day had the idea that capital was not necessary. All you needed was labor, and that was sufficient capital, you know, just a strong peasant with a mammoty or something was sufficient.
What was expected was this really. Now, most of these, except in the colonization schemes, the village expansion schemes, as distinct from the colonization schemes, the cultivators were already accustomed to working together. They did the common fence, for example, without each man fencing his own area. They would have a common fence around the area. That was allotted to them by the Velvidhanacha in proportion to his area. That was allotted. Then they used to lend. One man lent his buffaloes to the next man, and that fellow in turn lent his buffaloes to this chap when it was his turn. So they were already accustomed to certain practices, which helped them to do this in a kind of semi-communal fashion. And the government thought that this would be merely an extension of it. But in practice, with this larger extent to cultivate, their resources were not sufficient to cultivate the larger extent. So they might have done it with their small village patches.
But these are now scattered, right?
Not only scattered, but the extents were larger now, because they were having something additional to what they used to have. So their buffaloes and their mammoths and this, that and the other were not sufficient for the larger extent, although sufficient for the smaller extents that they had. Well, we tried to help them out to the extent of giving them seed and the implements, mammoths and so forth used to be given to them. Even ploughs, we made an attempt at giving them ploughs.
From the start itself, 38?
Not from the start. Well, I'm thinking of, I'm thinking really of the Elahara period.
That's after the war?
Yes, after the war, 1946.
So in Batikloa and Hambantota, you
didn't? No, we didn't have much. In point of fact, in Batikloa, there wasn't so much paddy land that I had occasion to deal with. It was mostly highland. Because in Batikloa, already there were large extents of private-owned land under the various tanks. And there wasn't very much irrigation development in the years that I was there. I was there from 40 to 43. It was largely a matter of improving the cultivation on the existing private lands and keeping the irrigation works going. There was what we called the Pattipulayaru scheme in the south, that is the biggest one.
That's Galloway.
Which is now part of Galloway.
I know, it was started by Birch in 1857.
It's the Pattipulayaru, is it?
Yeah.
But of course this highland cultivation of the highland allotments that we gave these people in Elahara, it was a really uphill task. The paddy was easier in a sense because you had irrigation for it. But getting a mango tree to get rooted and thrive there in that climate and in that soil is extremely difficult. But the paddy land itself was sufficient to give them an income if they went about it properly. And of course the houses were built for them. That was a very advance.
Even in village expansion?
In village expansion, no. In village expansion, we subsidized the house. We gave them, I can't remember exactly how much we gave them per house. And they had to, as they built the house, as the building progressed, we gave them in installments. And the installments there were really intended to take care of the doors and windows and the skilled labor required on the roof, that type of thing. Otherwise they were expected to put up their own houses. And I think the allowances given them were satisfactory, because these chaps could themselves build their houses. Mm-hmm. And there again, we were looking for a kind of communal effort. That is, that A, B and C would come along and help D with his house, and D, B and C would go along and help A with his house.
Did that happen?
It did happen. It did happen.
Well, with reference to the paddy lands and all this assistance in the post-war period, did that help to prevent them mortgaging their crops and prevent them from getting indebted?
Not entirely. But I think they were beginning to find their feet. And more recently, of course, with the guaranteed price for paddy, which gave them a kind of bargaining lever with the Mudalali, they are very much better off now than they used to be then. Even at that time, of course, on account of dilatoriness or the various sometimes unavoidable delays in government about giving relief to them, say for example a crop failed. By the time we went and investigated and persuaded the Treasury to give us an allotment and the Land Commissioner to give us money to pay these fellows and so on, it took time. Well, they couldn't starve all that time. They went along to the Mudalali and got what they could on what terms they could.
Mm-hmm. I read a recent account by AGA with Sociological Bias on Chandika Weber.
Mm-hmm.
And with all the paraphernalia of cooperative credit and other things today, still some fellows go to the Mudalali because they get other services. And cooperative credit is very good, but they also have to take their precautions. And once the chap is blacklisted, the blacklisted fellow goes to the Mudalali. So it's a...
Yes. It's... I don't think you will ever get 100%... emancipation from the Mudalali. Because situations arise where the cooperative cannot help you. Now a chap, say a man's child falls ill and he needs money urgently. Whom can he get it from? He's got to go to the local financier. Who's more often than not the Mudalali? The chap who runs the boutique is the local financier too, money lender. Well, he takes his opportunity.
When DS passed this ordinance, and I was wondering whether he was motivated by consideration of protecting the peasantry from Chettiyas and foreigners in particular. I was wondering whether he is, you know, while wanting to protect the peasantry from all types, he also wanted to prevent the land from passing into the hands of non-Chilenians.
He did. He did, from the stage of mapping out, in fact. Because there are, I think, all politicians at that time were very much concerned about the European holdings in the central areas. The other day I was speaking to Chandrasoma and he was telling me about problems that he had had when he was at Badulla, for example, that is where various stream reservations, for example, used to be enclosed or encroached upon by estates. And the Thatcheri had been much more lenient in dealing with such encroachments than with encroachments by the villager.
Mm-hmm. He told me that. Mm-hmm.
So, and very often what used to happen was that the estate encroachments may not be on stream reservations, but other types of crown land, maybe forest, crown forest and so forth, tended to be looked at with a great deal of indulgence, and you might give the European estate a permit for it and forget about it, whereas the villager might be brought to court or in any case deprived of the encroachment.
Mm-hmm.
So the land development ordinance certainly gave protection to the locality. But as I said, that might have made it more difficult for him to borrow money when he was in need. Then you had to face the question of rural credit.
Well, it has been unpopular, or rather shall I say, a section of the locality's campaigning against it. On this ground, you see, because they can't get credit and because they prefer freehold.
Mm.
But then they lay themselves open to losing the land.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was wondering how far this concept, this type of tenure, helped to improve production. Did it really give them incentives. That was the theory of it.
Well, they have been helped along a great deal, quite apart from the nature of the tenure as such, with the provision of irrigation facilities, for example. There was also this point that every government agent or assistant government agent who gave out lands in a particular area, it became his responsibility to make a go of this. And the land development officers, the chief headman, the village headman, they were constantly at these fellows. Because the headman's efficiency also was partly judged by how well these lands were cultivated. The government agent could pounce on the headman and say, you've not been going around and encouraging these people, seeing what seemed to be their needs, and telling us if it was the seed that they needed, and so on. Of course, as with all government institutions, much depended on how enthusiastic the particular officers were.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that this was a responsibility of the officers did help to make them take an interest in it and drive these people on.
I was wondering whether it was practicable. Did we have the infrastructure to implement it? Say before 49, in the context of the number of allotments given out in that period, did the old AGS system, was the old AGS system adequate to enough to supervise this form of tenure?
Now, if you consider them in the two categories of village expansion and colonization, so far as village expansion was concerned, by definition, it was intended just for the villagers. The village was taken up, and the villagers expanded into that. Went into that area and cultivated it. So that the headman by himself, assisted of course from visiting Kachari officers, could sufficiently, you would like to?
No, thank you.
Could sufficiently supervise and encourage that kind of expansion. But when it came to the colonization, and when it came to the colonies, I would grant that initially we started off with too little staff. Now, if you, my acquaintance, of course, is with Telaharra. Now, what happened there was that we had the ESLC, or Agriculture Corps, I think it was. They went along and cleared the land. The irrigation department came along and provided the channels. And the government agent went along and selected the LTs and put them, the colonies, put them in. Now, the work of coordination was not satisfactorily done. I, as government agent, being in Marthale, not being on the spot and visiting it possibly, say, once in 2 weeks or so, I couldn't be there on the spot all the time. The chief headman had his own other duties. The colonization area itself, I think, fell into more than one headman's division. And the headman, of course, had various other duties as well to perform. So that there was nobody on the spot looking after the needs of the colonists. Well, there was supposed to be, there was later a colonization officer appointed. And the colonization officer, if he went about his work properly, if he was enthusiastic, he could have done a great deal to fight things. But of course but the colonization officer himself, his, to supervise him was another problem. Subsequently, of course, we've had the land commissioner himself taking over these responsibilities, which I think was the right, was a move in the right direction. But really, lack of supervision. The AGA could not supervise the colonization offices sufficiently. And so the colonization of, you really, really depended on that the colonization officer was a conscientious fellow who went about his job.
Mm-hmm.
Because unless the colonization officer toured his area, regularly went around and sought the needs of the colonists, what was lacking, brought note to the notice of the irrigation, such where the channel is not functioning, and so on. Then of course the colonists suffered, and they got discouraged too, if the irrigation facilities were not there, and he couldn't get his field properly irrigated. Then of course there'd be complaints to the AGA, and the AGA has to take it up, he probably has to visit the place, call for a report to the colonization officer, and so forth. Well, all that is kind of corrective, but you really had to have an efficient man on the spot who would be sufficiently supervised.
Mm-hmm.
So that was that had not been properly taken care of.
Mm-hmm. Did you find often that irrigation was lagging behind schedules? And,
it was. More often than not it was. And also, I often found that, because these are a matter of detail, now the irrigation people, they work up their plans. They first have the survey made, the contour survey made, and then they draw their lines along which the channels are to be cut and so forth. But of course, the plans, the contour plans, may be taken at perhaps 5 foot drops, 2 feet, 2 foot drops or something like that. So although on the plan you might have a line running along nicely curved, there may be on the field actually, in between the lines, ups and downs. So the chap in the field may have difficulty in following the line set out on the plan itself, so that you have to make adjustments on the field. So if the chappie on the field is a chap who'll take a chance on it and who will go ahead and seek covering approval for what he does, you might get things done. But if he's the type of chap thinks to himself, no, I'll first report it back to my divisional engineer and wait for his authority to come along and so forth. Divisional engineer has a host of other problems to deal with. And this gets delayed, so this step just waits until authority comes.
Did that happen?
Oh yes.
This is after lack of responsibility.
I know. Yes. It often happened like that. Because of course this chap had other jobs to do as well. So it was not that he was idling. But he would leave this thing alone and get on to other jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So, meanwhile, this poor fellow who has to get the water there might not be getting it.
What about the caliber of the colonization officers themselves, at least the few you knew?
Now, I knew two chaps at Alhara. One of them was middling type. The other fellow was quite capable, very capable, I should say. But rather irresponsible. He could do, he had a grasp of what should be done, and he had, he could go around and get things done by other people, and so forth, but irresponsible in the sense that, it's a cousin of his getting married far away in Jaffna or someplace, well, he must run to it and spend a week and that sort of thing. He'd go there and send a telegram asking for an extension of leave and so forth. That kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering whether these sort of officers lacked the background and the status, both in background and in salary, for this sort of job.
Yes, generally speaking, I would say that the salary was not sufficient to attract good men. As a matter of fact, this very man that I was talking about, he did not remain very long. He was there long after I had left the place, but I know that soon after, maybe in a couple of years,
Wasn't there a tendency on the part of some of these officers to build their own nest eggs, cultivate vacant lots and...
I didn't find that happening, no. No. Mm-hmm. But of course, if any of them were corrupt, there were plenty of opportunity of making money.
This question of the adequacy of the infrastructure is considerable relevance. In the context of the fact that many of the allottees would seem to have wanted to evade the conditions, that to say, to put one of Farmer's arguments, he argues that under the traditional system there was a sort of semi-communal reciprocal aspect.
Mm-hmm.
But here, in the colonization schemes in particular, there was this individualized concept of units.
Mm-hmm.
And he argues that this was contrary to custom.
Mm-hmm.
Then again, having one heir was contrary to custom. Mm-hmm. They would have preferred to divide it among their sons.
Mm-hmm.
So they tended to try and get around these things by passive methods, you know. They might actually de facto, say, give a portion to their son and no one would know. Is it one son, another portion to a second son? And they would try to their best to evade these conditions. So in that context, considerable vigilance would have to be called for.
Well, So far as leaving the land to more than one heir is concerned, de facto, as you say, it did happen, but of course, on the documents, it was just one fellow who was entitled to it, and we often had cases where a chap who had the license, who had the permit in his name, came along to us and came along to the government and said, "Well, here's so and so squatting on this land. Please see to it that he's ousted." So we had to get it done. There was no option. And very often, or I wouldn't say very often, sometimes we found, for example, that this kind of thing happened. Say a man had nominated his son. Son was not on the land at all. Son may have gone away somewhere and got some job somewhere else. May have been as a peon in an office or something like that. Then the man marries a second time, his wife dies, marries a second time. And a good deal of the work and development of the land is done by that second wife and maybe her children. So the second wife comes to feel that she's got some moral claim on this. So she petitions the government agent saying, "Well, how about me?" So we would tell her, "Well, it's up to your husband. If he's the entity, and we can't compel him to one course or another. It's up to him." But he, of course, feels he has an obligation to the son to whom he has nominated, and so it remains. So, although this was not very palatable to these chaps, well, they just had to knuckle under. There was nothing to it, nothing for it. But I don't know whether that itself detracted from the effort put in.
Now, for instance, in those days, if you found that one allottee had maybe built a hut in that area, but had let all his paddy land out to someone else, what on arm they say, what would you do?
Of can't remember now what the terms of the permit were about on that question.
According to
there's nothing in the permit on it, is there?
According to the audience, as you can see, they can't have on there as far as I know.
Is that so?
Can't share crop.
Well, I suppose one would have gone into the circumstances in which, although of course the law might have said so, maybe that the fellow was ill and he couldn't get it done otherwise, and so he did this, otherwise he would starve, his family would starve and so forth. So I suppose we would like to look into the circumstances. But we would not permit him to continue in that kind of violation of it. And if he continued, we would issue a notice for cancellation of the permit. We did do that, where we certainly did it, where somebody else was in occupation.
And he had left. Of course, another practice was to let out only a portion of the land, but that might have been for very legitimate reasons of lack of labor.
Yes, but even that was very much frowned upon. We wouldn't let the other. As a matter of fact, that was, I don't know whether you are aware of what had happened in the Vavuniya district with this chap, Seniviratna. There was a chap by the name of Seniviratna, and he had started a scheme all on his own where he's a Kenyan, this chap. He was government agent Vavuniya.
Not Evgenius,
a young chap. I don't think he's in the service now. He was later in charge of the museum. He had these people. He had invited them, in fact, to get the Indians from the hill country and use them to work their lands for them and let them live on their lands. He thought this was a means of solving the Indian problem on the estates. He'd done this without consulting the land commission, and there was quite a row about it, and the fellow was taken away from Vavuniya, and minutes had been made by the government. He was not to be sent in charge of a district thereafter. So that was certainly frowned upon. There was no, we wouldn't let other people settle on it.
Of course, the problem with Andhra is to get evidence and find out that this has been done. We wouldn't know whether it's...
That is right. Generally not brought to our notice. We wouldn't know if it was just a labourer employed or on the Andhra system.
And the point about this Andhra being that according to the concepts, there's a unit, and once you give out a portion, you're dividing the unit. In effect, going against the de facto condition that you pass it, that it be held by one person.
But of course, the Andhra cultivator has been given a very much more stable position with the new Paddy Lands Act and so forth. Earlier it was not quite so strong, his position.
What about evictions? Did you, in your time, have to evict many people?
Fair number, yes. But when you say evict, merely to...
Cancel their
permit. Cancel, oh yes, plenty of that. But actually, physically putting them out, there wasn't all that. Because most of the cancellations were due to the fellows having left the place. So it was not as if they were staying on the land and not developing it, and therefore you had to push them out. Although there were a very few cases like that, particularly in the kind of suburban or semi-urban areas, where the allottee's interest in the land was merely to have some place to reside in. He wasn't concerned with land development as such. You know, labourers, people who come into town and work in the town.
Did you have any trouble from state councillors and local politicians when you tried to cancel permits?
No, I can't remember even one case, no.
My question on the infrastructure and the practicability really was with reference to Ande. And that's been one of the, sort of, shall I say, methods by which they got around it. I was wondering whether you had the infrastructure to prevent that sort of thing.
This may have developed very much later than my time, perhaps, but I don't think the problem arose in quite that form. Because now, in the village expansion areas, the people to whom the paddy allotments were given were themselves cultivators. We saw to it that they were active cultivators. We wouldn't give it to somebody who was just an office.